We're looking up at the stars. 2014 was a big year for astronomy. We had a couple of blood moons. We landed a spacecraft on a moving comet. We had a couple of meteor showers. So what's in store for 2015? Bob Bonnendurer is here to give us a preview. He's the director of the Daniel M. Soreff Planetarium at the Milwaukee Public Museum. Bob, welcome back to Central Time.
No problem. Glad to be here.
So I always wonder, you know, winter seems like a bad time, right, to get outside at night. It's cold. But then I think, well, it's probably less humid, less hazy. Is winter actually a really good time to get out and see the stars?
Winter's a great time because it's the brightest season for stars. You have the brightest constellations like Orion and the Two Dogs. And plus, you have the long nights, so you don't have to wait. You don't have to stay up late. So winter's a perfect time. Just bundle up and get out there on a clear night.
Oh, that makes a lot. You know, I hadn't even thought of that because I think of in August trying to catch meteor showers and stuff, and you're just, you know, waiting and waiting for the sun to finally completely disappear. Not a problem in the winter.
Exactly. It's dark by 5-6 o'clock, so head on out, and I got some planets out there. It's beautiful.
Well, we'll get into some of what we can see from here on planet Earth in a bit, but I guess we're sending some technology to take closer looks. Next month, a spaceship headed to the orbit of the dwarf planet, I want to call it Ceres. I guess I'm saying it wrong.
Ceres is right.
Oh, it is Ceres. Oh, great. Okay. Now, what are we going to learn about it?
Well, we just found out recently that Ceres has water. We always thought it was formerly an asteroid, the biggest asteroid. Now it's a dwarf planet. But we thought asteroids, well, they didn't have water. Now we find out it has some water, which is a big deal. If we ever go out and live in space, you want to live off the land, and if there's water, that's great. We hope to find out more about that. We've never been there before, so we're going to get just close-up, cool pictures of this huge rock and some ice in space.
Now, this is in the big asteroid belt, right?
Right, between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. Mm-hmm.
So what is the difference between a dwarf planet and an asteroid? Is a dwarf planet just a really big asteroid?
Pretty much. Sort of dwarf planets are big enough to pull themselves into balls, or be round, if you will. People think of asteroids, they think of potato-shaped things, and most of them are. But this asteroid, former asteroid Ceres, is big enough to pull it into a ball, and therefore it's a dwarf planet. It's kind of a thing to Pluto, because Pluto, we took its planet status away, and now we're calling it a dwarf planet.
Now, is Ceres something that, say, the home hobbyist could see with a hobby-type telescope from the Earth's surface?
Oh, you could definitely see it through a telescope. It would look just like a point of light. In fact, asteroid means star-like because it just looks like a star. It's barely on the edge of naked eye visibility. I mean, you'd have to be in perfectly dark skies and you might see it. In fact, it really wasn't discovered until the year 1801. And interesting thing about all these asteroids, they were first called planets because, wow, we figured out it's going around the sun. But eventually we found so many of them that they became asteroids.
And I imagine to see it with the naked eye, you'd have to know exactly where it was going to be in the sky to know that that's what you were seeing.
Exactly. It would be just way too tough. Not really worth the effort, but I think in a couple months when this spaceship from NASA called Dawn gets there, you're going to see some incredible images.
Well, I love seeing some of those images from space flight, those close-ups of the planets we can't really see. A dwarf planet, in this case, we can't see. And speaking of that, a craft on the way to another dwarf planet, you mentioned Pluto, this summer, something's going to land there?
Not land there, just fly by.
No, do a flyby.
Flyby, right. It's the New Horizons spacecraft from NASA, and this thing is amazing. It left 9 years ago, in early 2006. The thing is speeding through the solar system at 10 miles a second. Imagine driving around Wisconsin at 10 miles a second. Okay, and it's not there yet, but it's going to get there this summer. In about mid-July, we're going to get the first real good pictures of Pluto, which is going to be amazing, and can't wait for that one.
So what are we hoping to learn about Pluto when we get this close-up?
Well, we're going to find out, again, its composition more, how much rock, how much ice does it have, and just see if anything is going on the surface. We're always curious if these things are active at all. And Pluto in its elliptical orbit is a little closer to the sun now. And is there anything going on the surface? Icy geysers, which was a big thing discovered on some of the moons of Jupiter and Saturn and Neptune for that part. So is anything going on the surface? Anything working its way to the surface? Icy geysers? Who knows?
There's nothing that's going to happen that's going to promote Pluto back to full-on planet status, right?
I don't think so. Pluto's always going to be, in fact, for the holidays this year, I got a T-shirt from my brother that I talked about. I remember when Pluto was still a planet. You know, it's Pluto's fun to talk about, but it's probably going to remain a dwarf planet for a while.
Now, are there things we can learn from here at home, or learn about here at home on Earth from studying other planets and dwarf planets around the solar system?
Oh, definitely. We're talking about learning about the origins of the solar systems, you know, how these things form, how did the Earth and Sun come to be, all of that. And that's a big deal when we look even further into the galaxy, when we look at exoplanets, and we're starting to find more and more of those. I mean, how do things form? How do they come together? And it will help us better find possibilities for life out there. You know, what conditions have to be present for life to exist? So it's all about origins and curiosity and life, and that's why we go exploring.
Well, let's keep things close to home now, at least in astronomical terms. The moon, I gather we've got two lunar eclipses coming up this year?
Yeah, we have one on April 4th. We're not going to see a total one here in Wisconsin. We're going to see a partial eclipse in the morning for early risers. I think it's like 5:15 in the morning to 6:30 if you're up early on the 4th. And then, though, coming up on September 28th, we have finally a primetime total lunar eclipse from 8 to 11, basically, that night. Cross your fingers for clear skies.
Yeah, I was going to say 100% chance of serious clouds, I imagine.
I hope not.
That would be my worry. But that would be great. This is one we wouldn't have to stay up till 4 in the morning to see.
Exactly. It seems all the eclipses lately, the lunar ones, have been either the middle of the night or early morning, so this will be a nice one.
Now, are these blood moons?
They're called blood moons. It's sort of a recent term that's been coined by, well, picked up by the media. Every lunar eclipse since they started have turned red because of the sun's light being bent or refracted onto the moon, just the red part of the light's sunlight, though. So they've always turned red, but the blood moon has just been coined lately, and, of course, that gets people talking a bit. But, yeah, total lunar eclipses will turn red.
Okay, so we don't really need to call them blood moons, even though it sounds like the next installment in, like, the Twilight novels and very catchy.
Exactly.
And then another color moon, a blue moon coming in July. What's a blue moon?
Yeah, we like our colors, don't we? A blue moon is just an expression for the second full moon in the same month. And they come around about every 3 years, and we're going to get one this July, late July. And it doesn't turn blue. But it's just an expression. It's been immortalized, as many listeners know, with ice cream. There's been a song about it. So it's just been around at the tip of our tongue, and we're going to get one in July.
So suppose we're an amateur stargazer. We want to go outside sometime this month and try to find some key constellations, maybe easy to spot with just a little homework. What do you recommend we put on our list to try to check out?
Well, definitely start with Orion the Hunter. If you look east right after sunset, 5, 6 o'clock, you're going to see three stars in a line. That is the famous Belt of Orion. And then if you look left of that, you'll see a reddish star that's called Betelgeuse, though people like to call it Betelgeuse. It's one of the shoulders of Orion the Hunter. And then if you look to the right of the belt, you're going to see Rigel, a very bright blue star. And it's a great time to see color in the sky. Stars come in different colors. And then a little later, an hour or two, below the constellation of Orion, you're going to see two very bright stars. The brightest one in the night sky, has a real Sirius name. It's called Sirius. And that's known as the Dog Star. That's one of Orion's hunting dogs. And the other star to the left of that is Procyon. That is the Little Dog Star.
Okay. Orion, any other key constellations to check out this month?
Well, that's the best one. The Dipper will swing up in the northeast.
I'm good at spotting Dippers. That's my one specialty.
Yep, the Big Dipper is definitely visible. A little later in the evening, about 7, 8 o'clock, you'll see it crawl up in the northeastern sky. And remember, folks can use the Big Dipper, the front two stars. If you connect them and go above the bowl, you'll get to the North Star, which is not the brightest star, but it's a big deal because, remember, that's how people traveled and navigated around the world, using the North Star.
And, Bob, what is your favorite way to take in the skies in these winter months?
Oh, I just love it seems so much brighter, right? The darker skies of winter, you're deeper into the Earth's shadow, so it is truly darker. And the fact, as we started out, the winter sky is the brightest seasonal sky, and it's great to get out there and see all that. I call them my winter friends in the night sky because they return every winter like Orion, and they're just fun to watch. And we have the planets, too. Venus and Mars are in the south WestSky. They're going to get together for a cosmic dance in mid-February. They're going to be very close together, our neighboring planets. And then Jupiter's going to be around all night starting in early February.
Well, that's great. A lot of friends to visit with this winter. Bob, thanks so much for joining us.
You bet, Rob. No problem.
That was Bob Bonnendurer, director of the Daniel M. Sorreff Planetarium at the Milwaukee Public Museum.